This last lecture of the morning, I want to talk about cardiogenic thromboembolic disease in cats. It's a fairly common problem that we see, but a lot of times, a lot of our patients will never get to the tertiary facility of being treated because they're being euthanized very early because of a perceived poor prognosis in a lot of these guys. Whether that's that perception is real or not, it's highly questionable. If you look at some of the data and some of the research studies that's been out there that looked at a number of these cats. So just the syndrome itself has two factors involved in it. One is the formation of the thrombus, which is a formation of a clot or a in the heart or the vascular lumen anywhere within the body's surface. And then embolism of that, of a part of that clot, or whole parts of large parts of that clot, will actually cause the syndrome that we see in our patients. So it's not the thrombus that's the problem, it's the embolization of it. And you put the two together and you have the disease, thromboembolic disease. Well, like I said, this usually confers a poor prognosis. And when I talk to vets back home in Indiana, a lot of them don't send cases or basically stop at that point in time with treating these guys. But should this really be a poor prognosis in these guys? Some other terms that this disease has process has been known as is arterial thromboembolism, systemic arterial thromboembolism, FATE, or feline arterial thromboembolism. One of the terms we like to use is cardiogenic embolism to try to distinguish the fact that a number of these cats have underlying heart disease as an initiating problem in these cases, and that the embolism and the thrombus arises from that surface area rather than other causes. Well, when you look at the study, or a nice study, a retrospective study done by Stephanie Smith in 2003, you can see that the majority of your cases here, about 69% of your cases, have underlying heart disease, either HCM or unclassified cardiomyopathy, representing 27% of those patients. And then you have a group of miscellaneous cardiovascular disease patients that have about 17% of cases. Other causes include thyroid disease, and neoplasia is another high cause up there. And then there's a whole group that's undetermined cause of thromboembolic disease. And we've seen a little bit more of that. When I think about the cases, I went back through cases that I saw at Purdue. We had a number of cases that didn't seem to have any underlying heart disease. We have to wonder if other things are going on to cause these cats to be developing these clots. Just going backwards here. When you look at the overall occurrence of this disease, of cases presenting to North American Veterinary Teaching Hospitals, it only represents about 0.1 to 0.5% of all cats that present there. And then you look at the subset of cats with myocardial disease, it only represents about 6 to 8% of cats with myocardial disease will actually present with thromboembolism. Males tend to be overrepresented in these guys, but that also goes along with the fact that males tend to be the ones that develop the heart disease in this population. And also, you tend to find this in middle-aged cats about 7 years of age. Most common cats are actually just the domestic breeds, represent about 80 to 90% of those cases. However, some overrepresented pure breeds are present, such as Abyssinians, Burmese, Siamese, and Persian cats tend to be overrepresented as far as thromboembolic disease is concerned. Whenever I do these talks, I was talking to another friend of mine last night. She was like, you know, you guys always want to throw pathophysiology in this instead of just telling us what to do. We just want to know what to do. But I think in order to understand what to do and why we make the decisions we make, you have to understand some of the pathophysiology of what you're treating. So I'm a big pathophysiology geek. So you have to just forgive me for that, and you can wake up over the next 15 minutes after I get through this section. But generally, we think of thromboembolic disease, thinking of this Virchow's triad of events that occur. Blood stasis tends to be a problem, endothelial injury, and hypercoagulable state. And all of these three things are present in cats with heart disease. We have proof of blood stasis in cats when we look at echocardiograms of these animals with significant heart disease. I'm not sure how well you guys can see this, but you have your left atrium, which is sitting over here, your left ventricle down here. You guys can see that this heart is pretty thick, nice big left atrium. But then you see what we call spontaneous contrast in our left atrium here. this kind of cloudy appearance into what should be a hypoechogenic space. These cats are known to be at risk. The reason for this this smoke is because blood kind of sits and pools in this left atrium. And we know cat's blood, when it sits and pools, or anybody's blood, when it sits, if you drop your blood out, it sits, it pools, it starts to coagulate, the cells start to come together. Well, that's what happens in these cats with these big left atrium. As blood flow in the left atrium is decreased, the velocities of blood flow in these areas are decreased, blood sits there, and when new blood comes in and rushes in from the pulmonary veins, it creates this cloudy appearance as it kind of breaks up these formations or these rouleaux formations in these patients. So you can get this to work right here. Come on. Go back. Technology, who says it's a good thing? Just wants to keep playing here. All right, there we go. Endothelial damage is also present in these guys. As the left atrium gets bigger, you start to see signs of tearing or shredding of the endothelial surface in these animals. So stretching of the endothelial surface, as you're seeing here in this huge left atrium, you can start to see that the sub-endothelial areas are starting to be exposed, and collagen areas are being exposed in these cats. And this allows platelet adhesions and start the cycle of platelet aggregation in these patients and starts the development of the clot. And then there's the hypercoagulable states. There have been a couple of different studies in cats that look at altered platelet aggregation in cats. There are two good studies out there that shows that cats with heart disease have increased platelet aggregation when they're stimulated with ADP. And also, Wells' study was another really good study that showed an increased platelet aggregation of collagen with heart disease, although that study showed a slight decreased response to ADP. So a little bit of questionable data between the two studies, but I think both of them put together actually show a good study that these cats are hypercoagulable for whatever reason. The platelets like to stick together in these animals. So we have all the ingredients for Virchow's triad in these patients. One of the things in human medicine I put down here at the bottom that's being researched and studied, and we're actually trying to start a study with this, is looking at nitric oxide. In people with atrial fibrillation, they see a common sequelae of that is the development of thromboembolic disease and a thromboembolic stroke. And one of the research studies that's really been interesting is that we see in people that there's a decreased nitric oxide synthase in these patients that develop clots as opposed to those who do not. And you have to question if that is something else that's potentially going on in these cats. So it's going to be it takes a lot of elaborate studies in these guys. If that is reduced in these animals, that's highly suggestive that we need to be looking a little bit further on a lower molecular level and trying to prevent these thrombus formations from occurring in the beginning of this disease. So we put all these things together in our cats with heart disease. We have a combination of left atrial dilation from a number of the cardiomyopathies that we have, which allows to predispose us to subendothelial collagen exposure. We have altered platelet response in these patients, which leads to adhesion and activation of our platelets and platelet aggregation. We then develop increased coagulation or activate our coagulation cascade, and then we have a maturation of the clot. And once this clot is formed, you can have either large or superficial portions of this clot break off and go to different places. Well, the clinical presentation of our patients is highly dependent upon which site gets embolized. If the clot's just sitting in the left atrium, most of us won't even know anything's going on in these guys. Okay, you'll probably be ready to go ahead and do your dental or treat them with subcutaneous fluids for renal disease, all the other things that we have problems with in these cases. Until something like this happens, they throw a clot, break off portions of that thrombus to either both rear legs, which it seems to be the most common site, according to Smith's study of 127 cats, followed by the single rear leg, either right or left, or a single forelimb, which majority of those actually is just the right forelimb. So we may see these cats actually just present with intermittent lameness of the right forelimb as a common problem. what I find when I'm talking to our referring vet population back in Indiana, a lot of those cats end up getting worked up for arthritis or getting treated for arthritis rather than being worked up for cardiac disease. So we need to be aware that that's a very common site for these patients to embolize. The clinical signs of these patients are related to, once again, the site of embolus. It may not necessarily just be the legs. There's a number of other sites. The renal infarcts, we had a number of patients that present with just renal disease. Mesenteric infarcts can also be present. I had a client that came in recently whose cat basically had embolized a huge portion of the intestine. We resected it. The surgeons did. Resected that portion. The cat is actually doing pretty good right now, believe it or not. And that was his third embolic event. So don't give up on these cats. That's a really good story in these cases. Anyway, CNS signs can also be present. We have sometimes they may just present with seizures or neurologic signs where they're circling to one side or another. And then the classic sign of embolism to the legs include those four P's of paralysis, pain, polar, and pulselessness. And oftentimes, and in concurrence with these guys, we find that the musculature, depending on which area, which legs are involved, is very firm. And you may also have cyanotic nail beds, depending on the degree of blockage to these areas. Well, a lot of clinical signs are not just related to blockage in these patients. They're also related to things that happen as a result of platelets being activated. There's a number of vasoactive substances that are released from thrombus, including serotonin and thromboxane A2, which result in collateral vasoconstriction. One of the amazing things about animals, you can tie off both femoral arteries, both jugulars, and they'll walk around like nothing's wrong because they have tremendous collateral circulation. We do it all the time for procedures that we do that I'll talk about later, where maybe both femoral arteries get tied off. You don't get signs of ischemic disease. You can actually go in, there's a number of models where you can actually go in and tie off the aorta in cats, and you won't get the same syndrome that you get with if you develop a clot in that area. One of the research projects that we eventually did was we actually put little coil or embolic particles in a distal aorta and found that that actually created this syndrome. It's because when platelets get activated and adhere in these areas, you actually release these vasoactive substances, and your result is basically this syndrome of ischemic neuropathy. So a lot of the signs that we're seeing in these cats are probably related to a loss of collateral circulation and not just necessarily a blockade of blood flow to these areas. Other presenting clinical signs, vomiting is very common. Up to 21% of cases, depending on which studies you read, tachypnea and dyspnea, and up to 90% of cases. Once again, all of these are summations of a number of studies, so that's why the numbers vary so much. Some oscillatory changes that you may hear in these patients include murmurs, gallop rhythms, are both in only about 10% of cases. In a number of these cases, you may not have any oscillatory changes of these patients. So once again, it's basically by surprise that this animal presents with thromboembolic disease. Hypothermia is very common in up to 76% of cases, and concurrent congestive heart failure in up to 65% of these cases. Some other biochemical changes that you may see: hyperglycemia from stress, increased AST and CK from ischemic disease to the muscles, azotemia. This could either be from pre-renal disease, from congestive heart failure, or it could be from a blockade of the renal flow, basically because of a thrombus. It's very important that you get a basic biochemistry on these guys so you can have a baseline of where you are. And if infarction is due to embolus and it's getting worse over time, that may, or if the azotemia is getting worse over time, that may be more suggestive that the renal arteries are being infarcted or blocked with these emboli. Other things we see commonly probably are hyperkalemia, secondary to reperfusion injury. I rarely see any coagulation disturbances, but occasionally you do see and it has been reported. So how do we go about managing these cases? Well, there's a number of target areas that we need to focus on. Pain management, which is a major part of what the owners see in these guys. Improvement of arterial flow, including aortic flow or collateral circulation. Prevention, And this is becoming a big part of therapy, and hopefully some research is going to pan out to show that we have some things that may hopefully prevent these from occurring. Congestive heart failure therapy obviously is very important. You have to treat the things that would kill an animal first, and if they're in congestive heart failure, obviously we need to be doing something about that. And supportive care of these patients. So what do we do with pain management? Remember, pain is signs of pain are exhibited in these patients by vocalization. It's one of the first things that owners will see in these guys. Later down the line, it may also result from self-mutilation. Cats may become stoic. They often hide, rarely become reclusive. Anorexia is a very common sign in these guys, and increased heart rates on presentation. Treatment options are many, but most of the time, the opioids are probably the best drugs that we use. We tend to use buprenorphine the most in our patients, and you have a bunch of dose ranges here, things you guys can look up. I always have to look them up because I don't really do a lot of pain management. But we tend to use buprenorphine. Historically, acepromazine has been used for this purpose. And remember, we have to remember what acepromazine is. It's a sedative. It really doesn't do anything for pain management in these guys. And in actuality, in some cases, some people suggest it may be contraindicated in these guys, or the reasons that we use it may not actually be of benefit. And we'll talk about that a little bit later as far as the collateral circulation. So we tend to use buprenorphine to keep them quiet, keep them calm. And these drugs also work for patients with congestive heart failure just to try to decrease their anxiety a little bit. Oftentimes, I always tell my students, and some of them in here can attest to this, I always tell them the best thing to do to treat a cat with congestive heart failure is give them a shot in the butt and leave them alone, okay? Because you look at a cat cross-eyed, you'll kill it, okay? So the best thing we can do in these guys is relieve any anxiety that you have. By using these opioids. You also can improve arterial flow. There's some research out there, some new studies that looked at removal of these clots by embolectomy or thrombectomy. The most current one is looking at rheolytic thrombectomy in about 6 cats. There's a study that's been done out at UC Davis. And basically what this is a catheter is placed on a carotid, and it has a jet of water, basically, that is knocked into this clot, and then it's sucked up using venturi forces so the clot doesn't, the particles don't embolize to the rest of the body. They get sucked right up. Seems like a good idea, and did show good success in all 6 of the cats. It did work. However, only 3 of the cats left the hospital. And they've used it in cats from that had a clot. I think it was 8 days out. So that cat is the one that's actually doing the best out of all the group. The reality of that is that cat probably was going to do well to begin with if he was 8 days past embolus. So he probably was going to do fairly well. In the study, they claim that there was no reperfusion syndrome. However, I still don't know why the 3 cats didn't leave the hospital, whether it was euthanasia or not in some of these guys. So this is something that's going to take a lot of studying and looking at. Another big problem is, are these cats really stable enough to undergo anesthesia? And I know our anesthesiologists at Purdue, they don't like to deal with heart stuff to begin with. And then you tell them you have a cat in congestive heart failure with a thromboembolic disease, it's not stable, and you want to go in there and break it up. I don't think they're going to be too happy about that. So that's a big question in these animals and using these technologies. Surgical removal has also been attempted, but they had a huge problem with reperfusion syndrome in these cats, and a lot of them didn't survive the surgery to begin with. So most often you find that embolectomy, at least surgically or manually, is contraindicated based on the animal's physical status at that time. Dissolution by thrombolytics. Really, a number of great drugs that are out there, but has been disappointing to some extent in the results that we get. Streptokinase and tissue plasminogen activator are the 2 most common that are out there, or the 2 that are available for us. Complications were frequent in most cat studies, and I'll talk about those in a minute. It tended to be a little bit higher in those cats that had complete infarction of both rear legs. You tended to see those cats didn't do very well. And then those cats that had a delayed presentation tended to have more complications as far as reperfusion injury. So when we use these drugs, so looking at improving aortic flow, we have to look at the benefit to risk ratio in these patients. And that's a highly arguable point. If you ask 10 cardiologists that question, you're going to get about 40 different answers, to be honest with you, depending on the day. Streptokinase is a nonspecific plasminogen activator. It binds to circulating and bound plasminogen, which is a good part, but it's also the bad part because it creates a systemic proteolytic state in these patients, which predisposes them to bleeding and loss of coagulation factors. And you end up with an increase in FTPs in these patients. A dose that is typically quoted in these guys are 90,000 international units IV over an hour period, and then 45 followed by 45,000 international units per hour up to 8 hours. It comes as available as a 750,000 international unit solution. It's fairly cheap in that it's only costs about $300. However, if you look at the studies that were done, the best study out there is more would look at clinical thrombolysis with the use of streptokinase. Fairly good results as far as the clinical thrombolysis is concerned, with 50% of those animals having a return of femoral pulses and 30% return of motor function. And cats with single limb, 100% of those guys actually, especially single rear leg disease, 100% of those had a return of femoral pulses with about 80% return of motor function. The complications, however, in this case, may have outweighed the benefit in these guys in that 40% of them resulted in hyperkalemia. 65% of those cats developed coagulation disorders, and 26% had bleeding disorders, with 27% of those cats actually needing blood transfusions. And then you look at the overall survival rate. Only 33% of those cats actually really survived in the end. 39% of those died in the hospital from complications, and then 28% were euthanized because of quote-unquote poor prognosis. Now, that may have been, there's a number of things that go in factoring into euthanasia at this point, and money is often involved in that, not necessarily patient progress. So we don't know exactly the extenuating circumstances that led to euthanasia and the prognosis in these guys. So I've only used streptokinase myself in about two cats and with 50% success rate. One died, one lived, and that one that lived only lived about 30 to 40 days. That cat actually had bilateral leg disease and was completely obstructed, but I was surprised we actually got him out of the hospital for as long as we did. Tissue plasminogen activator is probably the one we use most commonly at Purdue. It has a high fibrin affinity, thus it generally targets the thrombus-specific effects. Bleeding complications are less likely with this drug because it doesn't create that generalized proteolytic state. The protocol we tend to use in these patients is 0.25 to 1 milligram per kilogram per hour IV to a total dose of 1 to 10 mg per kilogram. You see there's a huge dose range in these guys. And that's important in that we've been finding that we can get away with using these lower doses with getting some fairly good success, which allows us to decrease the cost of this drug to owners. If we buy the 50 and 100 milligram vials of this, it costs anywhere from $1,500 to $3,000, which is fairly expensive. Some of you may be able to afford that in here, but I work in academia. I know I could, for my own cat, I told him he's SOL. cat flow or activase is drugs that they use in humans for myocardial infarction. It comes in 2 milligram vials, which allows us to use smaller doses of this drug without wasting or having to put this whole expense for a bolus of $1,500 into a cat with a poor prognosis. Maybe we can get away with spending about $300 to $500 if we just use these vials and end up on the lower end of the dose. So it may have a very cost-effective benefit in these patients. One of the things we've been toying around with or playing with at Purdue is actually taking these bigger vials and splitting them up into smaller doses and freezing them to see if they're still activated. And no, we're not using those in our clientele patients. We're creating thrombus and then seeing if we can break them down as a later date. So it's something else that we may be able to use to decrease the expense in our patients. PIAM did a small study. It's one of the few studies that looked at TPA. And he showed a 50% survival. There weren't many cats in this study. It's a very small study. But the deaths were all related to reperfusion syndrome. So these cats were breaking down the clot successfully. But reperfusion syndrome was the problem. The surviving cats were all 100% bilaterally affected. So these are cats that we generally say have a poor prognosis. But he was very successful in breaking those clots down. 100% of those cats that survived reperfused after within 36 hours, and then 100% of those actually gained motor function within 48 hours. So these are probably things we need to look at as far as eyeballing a prognosis or giving us a prognostic indicator when we're treating these patients with this drug. Most of these guys, we tend to want to use these drugs that break down. Yes, ma'am. I tend to not go past I tend to go to that dose range. So if I get up to that 10 milligrams over that 24-hour period, I probably cut them off. But I've used and the longest I think I've used in a cat was 36 hours, and it really didn't work. At that point in time, it wasn't necessarily me giving up, but the owner saying that's enough. I don't have any more money to put in this cat, and probably rightfully so, to be honest with you. Generally, I like to. One other point I like to make: I generally don't like to use those drugs after about 8 hours of clot. These cats are being 8 hours out. I think those cats tend to have a higher risk for a reperfusion syndrome versus if we see them a lot earlier. Some guys I know, some cardiologists will still use them after even about 12 to 18 hours out. So. You know, I'm not sure what their success rate is, but personally, I don't see a good success after using about 8 hours. Improving arterial flow also means improving collateral circulation, which is why we tended to had to historically use azithromycin, basically to try to vasodilate these patients. But in actuality, this may tend to just shunt blood flow away from vital organs and exacerbate shock in some of these patients. So we strongly recommend that you do not use this drug in these patients. And it didn't show any benefit in dilating collaterals in these patients that had thromboembolic disease. Other drugs that we've used historically in these guys are antiplatelet drugs, which tend to have the effect to reduce the vasoactive substance released from these thrombi or these thromboemboli. Aspirin historically has the ability, at least in research studies, to reduce the release of thromboxane A2 from activated platelets. But it requires a significantly high dose if you look at the human studies, up to 150 milligrams per kilogram. Well, I don't know if any cats whose GI tract can tolerate that. They can barely tolerate the 81 milligrams that we recommend sometimes. So you probably don't get that effect at the lower dose of this drug. One of the newer drugs that we've done a lot of research in is Plavix or clopidogrel, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but we've done two studies that have shown that, one, we reduce platelet aggregation using this drug, and we also know that it reduces serotonin release by about 92%. In these patients with activated platelets using ADP. It also, in other species, has shown to reduce thromboxane A2 release. Now, in cats, we didn't really see that effect, unfortunately. So one of the things we've been suggesting is early on in a process of this disease, if the cats are not on this drug for preventative already, and I'll tell you why a lot of these cats probably should be a little bit later, but one of the things we've decided to start doing is giving them a loading dose very early on of this drug, about 2 to 3 times what we typically use on a chronic therapy. So we tend to give them 75 milligrams once a day for a cat that presents with thromboembolic disease to us. Whether that really gives us benefit at improving collateral circulation or not, that's the jury's still out on that. We'll have to start waiting and seeing. But from some of the research that we've done, we've seen that this drug actually improves collateral circulation compared to cats who are not on it. And that takes us into our prevention therapy. ideally, the best thing that we can do for these cats is prevent a thrombus from forming to begin with. However, we have no research studies and no drug that we know of that has proven to prevent a clot from forming in these guys. We have a lot of small in vivo research studies that suggest drugs will prevent clots, but nothing in vivo in these actual animals that are causing that have these diseases. But we still recommend trying to prevent these clots, and one day hopefully some research will prove that we are doing a better job than we think we are. And we still recommend it for these cats that have a left atrial diameter of greater than 1.7 centimeters. A lot of studies suggest that after this ratio, this tends to increase their risk of clot formation. Cats who have a left atrial to aortic diameter ratio of greater than 2, and then cats who have spontaneous contrast or smoke noted in the atria, we also suggest putting them on a primary preventative. And the reason we still suggest that is because if you look at all of those studies, all those numbers I kind of threw out at you guys, all these cats don't survive the first embolic event. So we can prevent or do something that may reduce the risk of these guys developing these clots. We may find that we improve survival rates in these cats with myocardial diseases and those that actually develop embolus. Most of our patients end up being secondary preventative, meaning we're trying to prevent subsequent cardiogenic embolic events. We find that once we've started treating these drugs, there's a high recurrence rate of about 40%. So a number of these cats will develop another thromboembolic event, usually within a 6-month period of time. Recurrence rates with therapy are reduced. Even some of the older studies that look at some of the older drugs, we do tend to reduce secondary events. Most of the studies suggest that we only have a 17 to 25% recurrence rate. The problem with it is that most of these are retrospective studies, and they're calling up owners and really trying to do surveys to get the actual information. So we don't really have scientific support yet that says that we are actually doing a job with these drugs. Well, one of the things that we've done at Purdue, and this is Dr. Hogan's brainchild here, is to do this FADCAT study. How many of you guys have heard of this study? Very good. Well, this is a study that's looking at the prevention of secondary and thromboembolic events, comparing clopidogrel versus aspirin. And in this study, that none of these cats have placebo drugs. Either you're on clopidogrel or you're on aspirin. These cats are out 1 month after the first event, and then we treat them for that month period of time, and then they come back, and then they get put on one of the protocol drugs. We have no idea which one that they're on. Only our technician, and I've been trying to beat it out of her, but she won't give up any information. We need about 10 more patients for this study, so if you guys have any cats with this with thromboembolic disease, you contact us via this website here that's flashing and annoying you probably. but it's in your notes. And it's easy to study. Just look up Fat Cat and you'll find this on there. It's a good study, and we've had a number of cats drop out already, and they all seem to be in one leg. We don't know which leg they are, but of course, scientific intuition and your hope is that it's the group that of the drug that's the historical drug like aspirin. But once again, we just don't know as of yet. Other drugs, other things that we've used as far as preventative care, the anticoagulants. These drugs prevent the formation of active coagulation factors. They also have minor antiplatelet effects. I'm going to fly through these drugs really quickly because we don't use a lot of these drugs anymore. The ones we tend to use are the low molecular weight heparins. This would cause Dr. Hogan and myself to sit down and have long discussions because I was a low molecular weight person and he was a Plavix person, so we'd go back and forth about which one we were going to use. And then you remember those Reese's peanut butter cup commercials where you argue chocolate peanut butter, and you start putting them together? Well, we started doing that combination at one point in time, and that seemed to be helping out and didn't have a lot of side effects. Historically, drugs that have been used have been warfarin, which I've only used in one cat, and I will never use it again. It was just a pain in my butt. Personally, just trying to get this guy regulated on warfarin. I did that as a resident just because I hadn't used it before. and I won't do it again. It's just really a problem trying to regulate them. Heparin historically has been used also, and like I said, the low molecular weight heparins. Warfarin inhibits vitamin K dependent factors. The problem with warfarin is that you have this highly variable inter and intrahepatic individual response with these patients, and it takes a lot to try to get them regulated on it. And basically, you do a lot of monitoring to try to prolong the PT baseline 1.3 to 1.6 times the baseline, or international ratio in these guys greater than 5 times. So I really haven't used these guys. And if you look at a lot of the studies with these, the problem with warfarin, it takes a lot of monitoring the first 5 to 7 days, or twice weekly for 2 to 3 weeks, and then once weekly for a couple of months, and then once every day. And the day is busy enough to try to do this with these animals. And then you have all of these complications in these guys with fatality up to 13% that's actually directly related to warfarin. And you have a high recurrence rate in these guys. So to me, it's not worth the effort in the end to try to use this drug. Heparin therapy probably has been the most common acutely used drug, the unfractionated heparins, to prevent further thrombus formation. Low molecular weight heparins are probably starting to take the unfractionated heparins' place, probably because we get a little bit more reliable drug levels in using this drug compared to the unfractionated heparins. And just as a quick reminder of where they target, the heparins themselves target thrombin 2A, and the low molecular weight heparins target factor 10A in their effects. The unfractionated heparins, the dose range is highly variable with each of these cats, and bleeding complications were high. The dose regimen here, you can get out of plums primarily. It's the same one we use. The target is to increase APTT 1.5 to 2 times baseline. But there's just no scientific data that supports using this drug in these patients to prevent further thrombus formation. The same could be said for any of these drugs, and also for these low molecular weight heparins, which are very expensive. And if you really get into the literature of these low molecular weight heparins, they've been highly efficacious in human studies. The problem in our patients is that one of the things that we're looking at to get the dose range is this anti-factor 10A activity of this. Well, there's this drug, this range that you're supposed to get anti-factor 10A to. Well, when I was researching this, I kept trying to, you know how you mail down stuff to try to find where you found this number from? I can never find where they found this range that says this is the range that actually prevents clot from forming. So the question is, are we really studying this drug appropriately by monitoring anti-factor 10A activity? There's a couple of nice studies that are out there that shows that this drug actually probably is not a once-a-day or twice-a-day drug in cats, but needs to be given almost 3 times a day to keep those drug levels higher. However, clinically, if you ask, if you look at some of the cats that I put on this drug, I still use it once a day, and a lot of these cats didn't have recurrences. So whether I'm still seeing clinical benefit, and you read some of the human literature, there's a strong suggestion that this drug has other benefits outside of this anti-factor 10A effect. And I think we're Dr. Hogan, who's becoming I call him the thrombus king, because this is what he likes to study most often. He's actually trying to figure out what another test that we should be looking at to look at low molecular weights effects. So the two drugs that we commonly use are Fragmin and Lovenox. Fragmin 100 units per kilogram subcutaneous. I know some cardiologists are using it twice a day. That gets fairly expensive to use it that much. And enoxaparin, once again, 1 to 1.5 milligrams per kilogram subcutaneous once or twice a day. And like I said earlier, current studies are suggesting that you need to use this drug 2 to 3 times a day based on its anti-factor 10A activity. Personally, I still only use it once a day. I just think the research that we need to be looking at is actually what actually prevents the clot from forming in these guys. And I don't know if it's based on my readings, I don't know if it's all bound up in this anti-factor 10A activity. DeFrancesco is probably the only group study that looked at survival in these cats that are on low molecular weights. There's a lot of problems with this study. In fact, that it was mostly retrospective as far as the warfarin group is concerned. What she did find was the low molecular weight group cats tended to live about 255 days compared to 69 days with the warfarin group. Although the recurrence rate tended to be higher in the low molecular weight heparin group, that may be a result of the fact that these cats lived a lot longer than the warfarin groups, more than anything else. Cost can be prohibitive for some clients. I tend to use this multi-dose vial, which takes the cost down from about $150 a day using the little single syringes. These multi-dose vials you can get in 9.5 mils, and you get all of the drug out of there. And some clients have said they've used that vial for up to about 6 to 8 months. So it's a high-end original cost, but it actually takes down the overall cost down to monthly cost down to about $80 a month probably. And clinically, when I last looked at this, I had 22 cats on dalteparin once a day. Eight of our cats at the time that I looked at this were on combination therapy. I know that has increased. Side effects, generally, we didn't have any complaints of side effects. We did have 6 recurrences. Two of the cats that were on combination therapy recurred, and we had 8 deaths due to progression of heart disease. 3 were related, seemingly, to a recurrence of thromboembolic disease in these patients. So where that all is going to bring us, we'll have to just, time is going to tell. A lot of these things are basically going to be time-related. Speaking of time, how am I doing on time? Okay, so I got 7 minutes to speed through the rest of this for you guys. And then inhibition of platelets, antiplatelet therapy, we touched on a little bit of this already. The idea of this is to prevent the initial adhesion, aggregation, and release of reactions of the platelets and prevent the vasomodulating effects using aspirin or this new class of drugs that called thionopyridines, tocopidine and clopidogrel in that group. Historically, aspirin has been used in these guys, and the idea of this drug is to prevent the arachidonic acid platelet response to arachidonic acid, and it did show good response to decreasing platelet aggregation using this drug. However, Burin in a human study showed no inhibitory response to ADP-induced platelets. The standard dose that we've used historically in cats are 81 milligrams per kilogram per cat every 3 to 4 days. These cats tended to have a high 22% report of GI side effects, and the recurrence rates vary tremendously depending on which study you read in these guys, up to 33%. And in one very small study, it was up to 75% of cats had a very rapid recurrence rate. Median survival time in these cats are 117 days, 180 days. So once again, these cats are living longer with these drugs. Better have something, seemingly, than nothing. These cats are not doing well if we don't do anything in these guys. Well, just as kind of reminder, I thought I took this slide out of here, but I guess I kept it. There's some theories that are going out right now. If you look at Stephanie Smith's paper, that by blocking the cyclooxygenase, we actually prevent both the good and bad effects of this cycle, meaning that we block the thromboxane A2 response, but we also block the prostacycline effect. So there's a lot out there right now about using low dose aspirin therapy. So instead of using the 81 milligrams, using these cats at 5 milligrams per cat every 72 hours. Problem I've had with this is that it actually ends up costing you more to compound the dang pill to the 5 milligrams. And it also the only thing that study really did show is a decrease in GI side effects. The recurrence and median survival time were about the same as using the high dose of those drugs. So we tended I tend not to recommend trying to do that. If I'm going to put them on aspirin, I still use the 81 milligrams in these guys. And then I talked to you about the Plavix already. Just a quick reminder of what Plavix actually does. It blocks the ATP receptor so that we don't get an activation of platelets when they get stimulated. The primary drug, the first drug that we used in that was teclopidine, but we found, and when we did a research study in these cats, we actually, this had so many side effects. When we walked into the room with these cats, they started vomiting and started salivating at the mouth before we even started giving them the drug. So we quickly left that drug and started using Plavix, which tended to have a lower GI side effects in these guys. The dosage that we tend to use is 18.75 milligrams once a day. Anything higher than that really wiped out the platelets. I mean, it was scary how bad it wiped out the platelets. But it achieved at this dose, we achieved a 95% inhibition of platelet response to ADP and a 92% reduction in serotonin release. The maximum effects occurred at 3 days and resolved after 7 days. So we're starting to wonder if we really have to use this drug on a daily basis. It may actually be that we can use this drug every other day or every third day, just like aspirin. And we saw minimal side effects. In a study that we've used these guys in, we saw one cat had mild GI gum bleeding, and we've had from client-owned patients rare reports of GI upset, and the cost is fairly inexpensive at $30 to $45 a day. So just kind of outcomes really quickly. If you look at this, conservative therapy, survival rates range from 35 to 39%. With thrombolytic therapy, range from 33 to 50%, and single limb patients and tended to do a little bit better. Up to 93% of those guys survived the first incident, whereas bilaterally affected cats had a higher, had a much lower rate of survival. And in death rates, you can see there's a high amount of euthanasia in most of these studies. Up to 35% of cats are euthanized in these studies. So what are some of the things that we consider poor prognostic indicators? In general, these patients have congestive heart failure. If there's another thrombus sitting in the left atrium, so it's very important that you echo these cats. Hypothermia, in most studies, the lower the temperature of these cats, they tended to not leave the hospital. Bradycardia also, for whatever reason, cats do just the opposite of what books say. Sometimes when they really get to that end, they start to brady down, and that's usually not a good sign. If this is a recurring event, and then worsening of renal azotemia and increasing potassium levels tended to be poor prognostic indicators for these guys. Surviving cats, you should take most of these cats about 4 to 6 weeks to regain complete, regain motor function. It may take months for some of these cats to really get back to normal as far as their motor function is concerned. Now, only about 5% of cats we have presented with are down the line developed limb necrosis. Or limb contracture in less than 2%, and basically amputating these legs will probably do the trick. It's a matter of having the owner realize that the cat will be perfectly happy with three legs. And survival time in these guys range from anywhere from 51 to 345 days in these guys. So recommendations that we have is do a complete workup in any of these patients that you present with them. Obviously starting with biochemistry and coagulation profiles, urinalysis to kind of assess whether we're dealing with pre-renal disease or renal disease. Thoracic radiographs and echocardiography is going to give you a nice baseline to see as far as if there's another clot or what heart disease that you're looking at. And while there's no scientific support, although there's a lot of research studies, there's really no good studies that are out there. What we tend to recommend is any cat with a large left atrial systolic diameter, smoke, or thrombus present, we suggest starting a single preventative therapy. Either we tend to use low molecular weight heparin or Plavix. We've probably started leaning more toward the Plavix. And the reason is because of that study I was going to tell you about was basically when we put cats on Plavix and then caused a clot to form in the distal aorta and caused this syndrome compared to cats that weren't on Plavix, we saw a significant reduction in the amount of time it took for these cats to recover from the neurologic side effects of this drug, and repeat angiography demonstrated significant collateral circulation in these cats. So there's something to the prevention of serotonin release in these cats that seems to be giving them benefit. So I've kind of jumped on that bandwagon of using Plavix in these guys and a little bit less on the low molecular weight heparin bandwagon. Combination therapy can also be used. The anticoagulants and antiplatelets tend to be synergistic. And if you have an event, we tend to use a Plavix loading dose. Bilaterally affected cats, because they have the worst prognosis, I tend to be the most aggressive with those that are trying to open up a clot. So I tend to use the thrombolytics in those guys. Whereas single limbs, I'm kind of, well, we can use it. We don't necessarily have to sometimes, because they tend to have a better prognosis even without using those thrombolytics. And I tend to use anticoagulants and antiplatelet drug therapies in those guys. So significant amount of research is needed in, this, in these guys, and we really need to start getting our research numbers up a lot higher so we can see exactly what we're doing. Are we really giving these cats any benefit when we use these drugs? So with that in mind, I'll take any questions that you have. I know I flew through a lot. Reperfusion injury basically occurs when these cats have blocked off, we've blocked off flow, and we basically go from aerobic respiration to anaerobic respiration. So we basically build up a lot of lactic acid and potassium byproducts in these non-perfused areas. And when we open up the blood supply to these areas again, all of those substances that have built up, those toxic substances that build up, basically now get back to the rest of the circulation in the body. And the reason you probably see it more often in these bilaterally affected cats, because the muscle mass are so big back there, you build up a lot of toxins in that process. Potassium being a big part of that. And basically that caused a lot of negative side effects on the vasculature as well as the heart itself. So that's a big problem. So we tend to use, in these cats that we're worried about that with, you may want to try to prevent a lot of the side effects by using glucose and insulin early on in those guys to drive potassium back into the cell, even calcium gluconate in some of these guys, although I've not really used that in a cat. So, yes, I think one and two. Usually, I'll tell you the honest truth to that is, the biggest limitation for us has been owner. If we're getting femoral pulses, I'll keep going with that. Oftentimes, especially with TPA, you have to use heparin in these guys also, because it's so short acting. When you basically stop that, they can develop a clot again. So you use a combination of both. Generally, if I'm starting to feel pulses again, that's a good sign. I probably start to get to that mid-range. I don't go oftentimes get up to that high 10 milligram dose, but if I get the mid-range dose, and then the other thing is owner cost is a big part of how much we can go, how long we can keep the animal in the hospital and keep going with the therapy. So that's been the biggest limitation for us. Yes. Did everybody hear his question? He says in a rural practice where you basically have this cat present to you guys, what do you do when they present? Stabilize them. Either try, if they need some fluid therapy, basically because they're in cardiovascular shock, that's one thing you need to do with them. Two, if you have, most of the time, you won't have thrombolytics available to you because we have to get to our hospital. We use our hospital to get that drug. But having Plavix, I think, on board, if you can put that on board these cats sometimes, I think you may see a benefit. I'm really starting to believe some of the data that we're seeing, and that a loading dose of that drug may actually be beneficial to them. So that may be something else that you need to do. Being very, I say fluid therapy, but once again, you have to be very careful with them. One of the things I always tell my students, don't use subcutaneous fluids in these guys, because if they have thromboembolic disease, they may have heart disease. And when you use subcutaneous fluids in these cats, you can't predict how fast they're going to be reabsorbed. And a lot of times, basically, they get reabsorbed a lot faster than the cardiovascular system can tolerate it, and it overloads them, and they go into heart failure. So a cat that's in shock, I would use IV fluids if I can before I get to them. Pain medications are a big part of that. That's funny that you say that. We just got into a big discussion with that with our critical list. I'm probably still a crystalloid person. I don't want to expand that volume too much in these guys. Okay. One other question? The question is a rectal temperature being a prognostic indicator. And if you look at the data, most of these cats that had a low rectal temperature they did not do very well. So yeah, I think it still is. You know, while some people suggest that that's not very accurate reading in these cats at the point in time, but you can tell these cats that are really hypothermic are really lethargic, really just laying there. They don't even vocalize very much, even though they are painful. They're really very stoic. That tends to be a poor prognosis, and that has panned out from what I've seen in the case that we've seen. So I think so. And a lower the temperature. That 99, 98 range is probably not so bad, but when you're getting around that 97, 96 range, that's when I'm starting to see these cats don't do well. Yes? I use 75 milligrams once a day. The chronic dose is 18.75 or a quarter of a tablet. It's basically one pill. It comes in a 75 milligram pill. So one pill when they come into the hospital. I know Dr. Hogan's like, I want to use it twice a day in these guys, but based on what I saw in these platelet aggregation studies, man, they wiped out the platelets. It really will knock them out pretty, their aggregations pretty nicely. So that really does well for them. Yes? Once a day, I'll use that. The duration, I'll probably just use that once and then get them to the 18.75. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I don't know the answer to that question. And the reason is because it oxyglobin does so many things to screw up things that you want to monitor. We tend to go away from using that in these cats. So I don't know if it really would help us or not, to be honest with you. And I don't know if it's going to be able to get to those areas that really need perfusion at that point in time, or improve collateral circulation. So the biggest thing is if we can open up those vessels, you probably would be okay. So the honest answer is I don't know the answer to that, but I know we tend not to use it in these cats. Okay. Thank you guys very much. We'll see you this afternoon, hopefully.